solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the next episode of Connecting the Dots, a series where we make sense of what we've learned across the 100-plus speakers of the podcast over the last 7-plus years. This time, we're going to be looking at staying resilient through quakes. If you're new to the podcast, I should mention that we are going through a phase where we are pausing collecting new dots and focusing on connecting them. I hope you will find these compilations of value. In a few months, we will come back to our regular rhythm of having new guests and adding to our library. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm based in Mumbai and my mission is to help growth-minded individuals play to their unique and full potential. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is finite and there are only so many people I can work with. Hopefully, this content can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen on playing to their potential. To know more, you can visit playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. Let's dive into the topic for this episode, resilience. I think it's critical to understand the word and clarify what I have in mind when I say resilience. Very often, I notice that people mix up resilience and grit. So it might just help to take a couple of minutes to make the distinction clear between the two. Grit is a trait that involves perseverance, passion, and a long-term commitment to achieving goals despite obstacles or setbacks. It's about having the stamina and determination to pursue goals with sustained effort over time. Gritty individuals are characterized by their willingness to persist in the face of difficulties, even when progress is slow or obstacles seem insurmountable. Resilience, on the other hand, refers to the ability to bounce back or recover from adversity, setbacks, or challenges. It involves adapting to difficult circumstances, maintaining mental and emotional well-being, and returning to a state of equilibrium after facing difficulties. Resilience often involves coping mechanisms, emotional regulation, problem-solving, and social support networks. In this episode, we will spend time talking about resilience. Let's start with how our childhood shapes resilience. I've come to believe that we all have a reservoir of resilience that we are born with, but it's only some of us who have been exposed to situations to really tap into it from early days. In the podcast, I spoke to Rupa Kudwa, who was the MD of CRISIL and subsequently the managing partner at Omidyar Network in India. She speaks about how she could not make it to IIM Ahmedabad the first time because of some silly technical delay in getting her mark sheets.
I graduated from Cotton College in Guwahati, and I graduated in statistics and mathematics. And before that, after I finished school, I'd actually come to Bombay for a year and joined Sydenham College, where I was hoping to do my BCom. And within a few months of my coming to Bombay, I realized that I just hate this place. I couldn't adjust. I'd grown up in small towns. I found this city quite overwhelming. And at the end of 1 year, I told my parents, I want to come back. And to their credit, they didn't say why. I think they could figure out that this wasn't working for me. And they were very gracious about it. So I went back to Guwahati and I took up statistics and mathematics.
And you had to start afresh?
I had to start afresh. And then in 1983 was when I got admission into IIMA. And I was due to join on the 1st of July, 1983. And at that time, I am expected us to have our graduation mark sheets. But because of the anti-foreigner agitation and the students' movement in Assam, our exams got postponed. And on July 1, I didn't even have, not only did I not have my mark sheets, I hadn't even written my graduation exams till then. And so I requested IIM to see if they could defer my admission to next year, not knowing whether, you know, this was a fluke or whether, you know, I would even get in another time. And unfortunately, their rules at that point did not allow a deferral, which is why I had to write the exam again next year and take the interview. And fortunately, I made it a second time. And it turns out it wasn't so bad after all. You know, in the interim, I was a school teacher. I taught in a kindergarten school. And it was interesting that I had no plan B. If I didn't get into IIM, there was no other plan. So I would probably have ended up becoming a school teacher.
Wow. I heard something similar from Dheeraj Pandey, who co-founded Nutanix, which is now a $14 billion company. He speaks about his experience with the IIT entrance exam.
But the thing that made me sort of choose things in life were always based on this thing that said, the worst is not bad enough, go take that step, if the worst is not bad enough.
Interesting.
So you always thought about the worst case, and if the worst was not bad enough, the risk was worth it. That's the way I took to my early years. So, you know, I went to IIT in 1992, but I had a rank of 1420, and right. I realized that to get a brand change would probably be a lesser probability than if I were to quit and go back and take JEE one more time and get CS. The probabilities were higher that way. And most people
around me... And you modeled the probabilities from the inside or from the outside?
From the inside. I mean, okay. I was there for 2 months.
Got it. So you got a sense of what it took.
Okay. Yeah, I was there till October, and most people were like, what are you doing? You know, you have a great thing going here, and by the way, at worst case, you'll get double E, and that's good enough, and so on. And I said, I just haven't tried, hard enough. Let me just give it a try because the probabilities are way better there. And I knew that worst case, I'll just do physics, you know. I mean, maybe do St. Stephen's and do physics or something, you know. And there'll still be a path from there or something. If the worst is not bad enough, then I'll just take that. So I think I've used that throughout life, actually. The worst is not bad enough, then just go do it.
I see a couple of things here. One is the fighting spirit and not wanting to settle. And the second is a very active problem-solving mindset to calculate the various probabilities and implications of the various pathways. I was recently watching the movie 12th Fail, which won the Filmfare Award for the Best Film and Director. It's a wonderful watch in this context. It's based on the real-life story of Manoj Sharma, who after several trials and tribulations, makes it to become an IPS officer. I come from the Indian middle class, and I have had my share of struggles and failures in my early years. Now I'm in a slightly comfortable place economically, and the one thing I lose sleep over is how I can make the kids resilient. I don't think I have a clean answer to this, but this angst was communicated so aptly by Atul Kasbekar, who's now a celebrated photographer. He speaks about his struggles while transitioning from a career in engineering in UDCT, a reputed chemical engineering college in Bombay, to photography, an area he was passionate about.
So, you know, when I started investigating what professional / commercial advertising photography would entail, first of all, when I asked myself, the two things that I enjoyed doing, one was writing, and I edited my school magazine called the Campion Review.
Right.
And the other was this. And at that time, honestly, the profile of the writer, which again mercifully has changed, was this left of center, jhola carrying, khadi clad guy who sat at somewhere when he could afford it and discuss all the problems in the world that he was never going to solve anyway.
Yep.
You know, and the last thing I was going to be was commie. You know, I'll be a capitalist pig till I die for sure. So I said, yeah, that I can't do. Plus, it seemed like you'd be scrounging around for a living.
Yeah.
You know, and that was true at that time.
Sure.
Okay, so I said, we'll do the other thing that I enjoyed. So then I started investigating more, and I, wherever you looked up any magazine where there was a byline, inevitably a picture I liked was happened to be taken by Gautam. So I had no idea how to connect with him. I knew nobody in the business in any form. So I went to the phone directory and he wasn't listed. So, and Rajadaksh is a fairly common surname in Mumbai. So there's a lot of them. There were like, I don't know, 10, 20 pages of them. So every third or fourth Rajadaksh would call and confidently say, can I speak to Gautam, please? And they said, no, wrong number. So after must be some 100 phone calls at 1 rupee a piece or whatever it was at that time, finally it was some cousin or something. He said, no, haan, number nahi hai. Please.
So it's like the brute force method, huh? Just one after the other.
So I said, let's not call each one. Let's just go every fifth, every sixth. And then took a little highlighter to mark. Ho gaya. Let's not call this guy again. He slaps me in case I have to go back to the start. So every day I would make like 10, 20 phone calls. And I finally, someone gave me the number, which was landline, of course. So I called him and I said, listen, hi, my name is so-and-so. Please don't hang up. I need 2 minutes of your time. This. And, I was wondering if I'd come and meet you. And I'd like to know more about what the profession is all about. So there is silence at the other end. He says, I'm at Lintas. I work there at Express Stars. Come on, this is his date. I'm like, wow. So I'm going to meet the great one. So I go there and meet him. And he was, took a great shine to me. And, we remained friends. In fact, he passed away. And all Gautam did actually was give me time. It was more like a patient and a shrink kind of, scenario. And it was just a reassurance that, it's a respectable profession. It's not the guy who says cheese at a wedding, because that's, it's a photographer. That's the first image that came to mind. Are you going to be at wedding saying, sir, thoda closer, kind of thing. And, and there's Mitter Bedi and there's, Adrian Stevens and this is the kind of stuff they do. I went for one shoot that he was doing with, Vilas Bhende, and watched one shoot in action and so on. So I never really assisted him, hung out with him on one shoot.
And this is all when you were pursuing your UDCT degree or you decided to move on?
No, so this is at the end of the first year.
Okay.
And then through that second year period.
Got it.
And then I just registered at Xavier's just in case my applications didn't go through.
Plan B. Okay.
And whatever. And, at that time, it was really bizarre. And people have no idea how tough it was. There was no provision for you to get official foreign exchange to go for a bachelor's degree abroad.
Wow.
Yeah. So now you can go for anything. You couldn't go.
So how would you find
exactly.
Yourself?
So my dad said, I'm not doing any hawala nonsense at all. And, these good Gaud Saraswat Brahmins from rooted from Karwar, they don't do such things. So he said, you want to go, I have no problem, but you please get an official permit. I'm like, how do you expect me to do that? He said, now go figure it out. So I went to the RBI rule book. They said there are only, you can go if A, you prove that it's not available in India, and B, which is the...
That degree is not available.
Degree is not available in India, and a bachelor's program. And the second thing is you have to prove that it's useful for the country. Now that is now so...
Subjective.
What do you say, man? So... Now, then I realized that, our people, nobody in our country wants to take want to take a call and put a letter down that actually has no harm to them. But, they don't want to do it. Why? Because why take that
unknown
1% chance of whatever? So if you write to Bombay University and say, give me a letter that says that, So I told them, this is my problem. You need to tell me that this degree is not available in whatever. They won't give you the letter. So he's saying, okay. I said, no, but I have to. You don't have it, right, in Bombay University? They said, no. I said, so why can't you write it and say, I don't have it? Then they thought to themselves and they said, okay, I tell you what. You write to us saying, ki, I want to study photography. Where in Bombay University I can do it? And then we'll say, we have no such course. One line. Which is in direct reply to your reply. So,
You take the onus of... making the claim.
Huh? Yeah. So I did that from 4 or 5 universities. And Bombay, at least you can go there and catch somebody, in the office. Now get it from Delhi. Good luck. So I would send letters to them, registered with a self-addressed stamped envelope inside. So you just have to make it easy for you. Just slip it in and send it back. you know, and 16 reminders later. So I got 4 or 5 of those, wow, first of all, to prove in India. And then I literally went and beat down the doors of every single ad agency. This is a random stranger walking in. Ki, sir, please, Mohammed Khan, you know, this is the thing. I've got this. I need the second part. As many documents I can get from people saying photography will be useful for the country. Will be, please word it in your own way.
So this is for Forex.
Forex.
All this is for just Forex. Having...
This is after my dad said, you can't go if you
this
can't...
Is, you've got the admit. And yeah. Now you're trying now to organize the Forex. Official Forex.
And it wasn't very much. It was like $6,000 a year. You know, so, at that time. Well, you know. So then I must have got literally like 50 letters from various people. Every ad agency, any person, whatever, karke, and this is just going there. And actually, I should tell my kids this, you know. And this is what I mean about safety net. My dad took it away. He said, "Tere ko jaane ka hai to, you know, do the mehnat na."
Figure it out.
And then at that point, I said, "Yaar, whatever happens now, I will make this work," you know. And so then, I think we put it in a sense of perspective. I'm actually quite shocked that now that I think about it. I mean, you walked into enterprise and said, "Do you have an appointment?" No. Can I meet Mohammed Khan? Seriously, you know. So can I meet Alec Padamsi? Who are you again? You know, sir, this is my problem. This is, you're talking to the receptionist. To get past the receptionist whose job is to stonewall you. You know, and no, you can't, please. And he said, please, this is my problem. Can I speak to his secchi? His secchi at least. So at least you pass that. So this is the thing. Can I write a note? I'll wait. There goes the day.
It's persistence, right? Yeah, you know? No, and so, a couple of things, Atul. One is, even going back to the Gautam conversation, it wasn't a I want a job conversation. It was a let me figure out what this profession is.
Yeah.
And then conclude. So I think that when you have that, I think it sort of elevates you in a certain level, saying, you know, I'm not here desperately to sell myself, but really genuinely to find out if this profession makes sense for me. So it's interesting that you sort of structured it that way. And second is, from an entrepreneurship standpoint, I mean, one of the things I've heard from people is you're always opening doors much bigger than you. It's a bit like what you just described. Every door that you were trying to open was probably much bigger than you at that stage.
Oh, yeah,
sort
yeah.
of just having the tenacity to keep knocking and keep the faith, I guess.
And I think it just bore down from just, you know, just passion. Hmm. You know, now I've seen a couple of shoots. I think I'm pretty certain this is what I want to do.
Got it.
And I have a feeling I'd be good at it, you know. And, you know, and then good or not good, I know, okay, I can, like...
It's worth a shot.
I mean, I'll be good at it. I don't know, successful or not, but it's definitely something that I can, you know, do. So that's the, and then you just sort of do it, yeah, you know. I never thought in terms of, like, I was telling my kids the other day, I met this guy from Rajasthan, okay. Tried very hard to, you know, meet with me, and I didn't give him time of day. There was no connection. He just wanted to meet. So, sure. Finally, he connected with someone in the office, then someone who didn't give him time of day. He finally connected with one very sweet guy who basically loves a sob story. And he got suckered into coming to me to saying, "Sir, I think you should meet this guy." I said, "Why?" You know, I mean, like, we don't, are not involved in that thing. He's messaged me before, etc. He said, "No, I think there's some interesting things. We could probably have some synergies, etc." Finally, I met with him. Not a whole lot happened. Essentially, what he was doing was he was selling, you know, things like Facebook likes and, you know,
wow, okay,
Instagram followers, and, you know, I can get so many views, whatever. And his thing was that he was selling them to the digital companies who were selling them on to the music companies and production houses. He said, "Sir, you can open all those doors. Why don't you get into a partnership with me? We can make a lot of money. Here's the money that they're overbilling for things I'm doing for them." So I said, "See, I just find that grotesque to think that you need to buy these things and say, 80 million, so many million views and so many, and actually it's not the case. They're a bunch of bot accounts or whatever, you know. So I said, I don't want to do it. But I was telling my kids that, I said, the guy can't string 3 straight sentences in English.
Right.
Okay. He has not let that hamper him. Okay. He wants to now open a way bigger door, and he has just not taken no for an answer. You know, I said, now in your line of work where you've been so mollycoddled along the way and wrapped in cotton wool from your home bubble to your lift bubble to your underground parking bubble to your car bubble,
yep,
then you're fully insulated from the universe,
the real life,
and you,
yeah.
Yeah, and you reach your school bubble, college bubble, da 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 da, airplane bubble. You've just been bubbled through the entire system,
yep.
And I've jumped railway tracks, I've jumped into, you know, running buses, whatever, no problem. Every person wants a better life for their kids than they had.
Sure,
no problem. And I'm saying, बाहर जाके ना चार धक्के खाने चाहिए बिकॉज द ब्रूटैलिटी व्हेन दिस गाय कम्स इनटू द रिंग विद हिज फिस्ट स्विंगिंग यू हैव नो चांस बिकॉज ही विल च्यू यू एंड स्पिट यू आउट एनी डे ऑफ द वीक बिकॉज यू आर जस्ट नॉट स्ट्रांग इनफ एंड यू आर नॉट tenacious enough and you're not
and he's heard a lot more no's than you right so many people have told him no and he sort of like you has kept knocking and some door somewhere will open
correct
guess, right
you know and you just don't whatever. So you know I find these stories quite remarkable so nothing happened but the take from this was ki yaar he managed to do what he wanted to do which was get face time
eventually got to it yeah got the time he wanted
yeah right.
As a father of two young kids 14 and 10 I don't have a clear answer to where all we can pop the bubble wrap, but that is something I really end up spending time thinking about. There is something to be said about creating some adversity in their life by design, but I've also noticed that very often they see through it and they know that the adversity is not real. If it's a space where you have ideas and have tried something that's worked for you, I would love to hear from you. You can just email me at deepak@playtopotential.com. I can compile the ideas I receive and share the aggregate ideas with the people that email me. In the rest of the episode, we will first look at how individuals have stayed resilient through failure and what we can learn from them. Once we've looked at being resilient individually, we will subsequently look at how leaders can create a culture to breed resilience in their organization. In this context, the first insight I want to share is something I learned from the writings of Sheryl Sandberg. She discusses this in her book Option B that she has co-authored with Adam Grant. She speaks about not falling victim to three P's, personalization, pervasiveness, and permanence. Personalization is the temptation to blame oneself for the adversity or believing that it was caused solely by one's own shortcomings. Pervasiveness refers to the tendency to see adversity as all-encompassing, affecting every aspect of one's life. There's a tendency to say everything is doomed. Permanence involves the belief that adversity will last indefinitely and things will never improve. If you want a sneak peek into this thinking, you can just look up Sheryl Sandberg and look up her speech at UC Berkeley on YouTube. When I look at my life, I notice that very often I end up falling into the trap of three P's, especially pervasiveness and permanence, especially if I've had a health episode, let's say a frozen shoulder or a bad back. I find Sheryl's distillation very valuable in the context of having the right mindset to deal with shocks. In addition to the three P's, I would say another P which I feel makes a big difference to our resilience. When I look at people who deal with failure and are resilient, they often have a core reason or a purpose that keeps them going through the rough and tumble. They keep telling themselves why they need to fight that battle and why it matters. Deepa Malik, a celebrated Paralympian, speaks about how she dealt with life when she was dealing with two shocks. One was being paralyzed waist down when she was a young woman, and second was dealing with her husband fighting in Kargil around the same time. She speaks about how she had two kids, 7 and 3 years old, and that gave her the will to fight and thrive despite the challenges that were thrown at her.
You'll be surprised. I even got operated in the hospital, which was a major place where all the war casualties were flown in. That was Referral and Research R&R Hospital, New Delhi. I was referred from Jaipur to New Delhi. And while I was undergoing my checkups and the decisions of the surgeries, every hour a chopper would land. And the moment we would hear the chopper, the blades, the noise, everything would stand still for that moment. And my only question in my eyes that doctors could read was, may I know if my husband is alive? So, you know, it was a very difficult time when I look back. But again, there is a paradox out there. The thing which scared me the most gave me the most energy to face my own loss, because there were soldiers, average aged 25 years. Somebody had lost a leg, somebody's eyes had blown off, somebody had got paralyzed because of bullet injury in the head, or somebody was perhaps going to die in some time. And I say that And each one would smile because what they had done was towards their nation. It was the line of duty. It was a level of patriotism. The higher the injury, the higher the love for the country. And they were not cribbing about it. Then what reason did I have? Because mine was a disease. It wasn't that I chose to go there and get paralyzed. So that gave me innate strength. At the same time, it gave me the biggest fear of losing my husband, because if I was going to either die on the operation table or remain chest below paralyzed, because at that point of time, I had no clue what is going to happen to my life. And the way everybody was reacting to that news given by the doctors, the general stereotypical impression given by society to me was that my life is going to end there. I'm going to be homebound. I'm going to be room bound. I will never be able to step out and do normal things in life. Or perhaps here on, I'm going to be a liability on the family. So it was scary. But yes, we did good. I won my battle over paralysis and my husband won the battle in Kargil, and we are moving on.
and again, at that time, I read one of the articles which said that you had a choice between living on a wheelchair or continuing to walk till the end and face possible death. There was a choice to be made.
I chose life.
And how did you, tell us, how did you think about the decision?
I think motherhood was my biggest strength. I wanted to be alive to see my children grow up, because my daughters were barely 7 and 3 and they were very young. And I think I was very possessive about my kids. I didn't want them to be brought up without my supervision. And I think that became a huge, huge strength. I'll be very honest. It was purely motherhood that made me choose to live. But eventually, disability gave a focus to my life. And it also gave a direction that I could, if I use my education in the right spirit and all the values which have been given to me by my parents and a supportive in-laws, so I could probably put all this together and make a difference. And I'm glad I was able to do that to an extent, though there are miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep.
In a way, something similar comes up in the work of Viktor Frankl, who's written Man's Search for Meaning, a book where he chronicles his experience in a concentration camp. Viktor's survival through adversity in the German concentration camps can be clearly attributed to his ability to find meaning and purpose despite all the suffering around him. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Let's press a quick pause button on the episode. I hope you're seeing value in this content. When we started this podcast in 2016, podcasting wasn't quite a thing, and we were one of the few that were walking down this path. Now there are thousands of podcasts and other content pipes that are screaming for your attention. If you find this podcast content relevant and of value, do take a moment and like and review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you consume the content. Do also share it in the communities you belong to, whether it's work, classmates from school or college, or the residential communities you live in. I've come to realize that for us to make a difference with our content, there's no point if we focus on the content creation without doing enough to get the word around. If you're a recent entrant to the Play to Potential podcast series, I should update you that the Connecting the Dots series is a temporary endeavor where we try and make sense of the insights we've gleaned from the 100+ guests over the years. Prior to this episode, we've connected the dots on self-awareness, listening, identity, breathing life into work, and habits. You might find some of them of value if you're liking this format. Thank you for investing your attention at the Play to Potential podcast. We take the responsibility seriously, and you have our word that we'll do whatever we can to ensure that you're getting the ROI on the attention, which is arguably the most scarce resource that's available at your disposal right now. Let's get on with the rest of the episode. Earlier in the podcast, I had a chance to speak with Ramesh Srinivasan,
a senior partner with McKinsey in the New York office. A few years back, Ramesh and his wife Charuta went through the unimaginable trauma of losing both of the children to cancer. It's hard to even begin to imagine what that would feel like. When I asked Ramesh about how he came out of those twin shocks, he speaks about how Charuta and he have found their purpose post the two events. But he also speaks about the criticality of going through a recovery phase before going into the reimagining phase.
And I don't talk about it that often, but I've decided to do it to be helpful to all your listeners, Deepak. Unfortunately, my wife, Charuta, and I, we've lost two kids to cancer in the last 10 years. Shruti was 9 years old when she passed away in 2009, and Aditya was almost 12 when he passed away in 2015. And both Shruti and Aditya were amazing kids. They were smart, extremely positive, very wise for their age. And that really has pushed both Charuta and me to think about who we are, why we exist, what is our own purpose. And I think the more I think about it, I've come to a realization that my own purpose is to bring a source of positive energy, possibilities to the world. The smile I bring is the asset, and I represent this positivity for everybody going through a tough time in this world of so much demoralization. I represent optimism and hope. And McKinsey has just given me a platform to be able to do this and do this at scale and have impact. And I feel very, very blessed, Deepak, that the universe, our family, our friends, you are a part of that, have all helped me and Charuta sustain ourselves as we go through this journey, Deepak.
It's hard to imagine what you might have been through, Ramesh. And if I may, please feel free to move on if we need to. But one of the elements also is, how do we handle it when we are going through it, right? At some stage, you're able to look at it with a little bit of distance now. But especially given all the trauma we are seeing around, given COVID and even otherwise, if you had to reflect a little bit on what you would tell people when you're going through these periods of extreme trauma, if I may use the term, any perspectives you'd like to share, Ramesh?
Yeah, and we've touched on some of that even during the session, Deepak. We talked about the two phases of, call it the survival / recovery phase versus the reimagination and setting the purpose phase, right? So thinking about where you are and having an honest assessment of your state of being, state of mind is very important. And when you're going through that trauma and the intense trauma, I have found it important to, again, really have practices that help you deal with the anxiety, being present, taking it one day at a time. Both Charuta and I would always say, do we know, and some of the doctors we worked with at Memorial Sloan Kettering, they were incredible advisors to us to say, take life one day at a time. Do you know what you need to do today? That's great. If you need to plan for a week, that's useful. Whenever we would ask them about the prognosis of our kids, they would say, if we give you too optimistic a view, you're going to then, if something bad happens, come back and blame us and lose credibility. If we give you too pessimistic a view, you will not live your life. And like, what's the point? So really being, taking life one day at a time is what we found helpful. And that's my advice.
I've had an opportunity to work with Ramesh closely in the context of Akanksha Foundation, a not-for-profit where he's on the board. And I can vouch for the positivity, energy, and purpose that he brings in the way he shows up in the interactions. I find Ramesh and Charuta to be great inspirations on how one could lead a life of purpose and meaning despite being dealt with two cruel blows. While Ramesh speaks about recovery and reimagination as two phases, one of my other guests, Bruce Feiler, author of the book Life is in the Transitions, uses a slightly different language to make the same broad point. He urges us to look at scars and not at wounds when it comes to making sense of what's going on.
So I think that the foundational way to think about this is that everybody listening to us could just stop for a second and listen, kind of summon up that story that goes on in the back of your mind, kind of on low level. The story of where you came from and who you are and what's important to you and what you've done in your life and where you are right now and where you want to be going. Like if you got a call right now that a loved one was in the hospital and you went rushing to the hospital to take care of that person, you would imagine the time that you spent with that person. What do they mean to you and what you would say to them? That story that is kind of running in low volume in our minds all the time, that is the story of who we are, okay? And that we now know is not just part of who we are, it is who we are in a fundamental way, right? Life is the story that you tell yourself. And what we're talking about fundamentally with life quakes or life transitions or crises or upheavals or, you know, whatever names have been given to this over the centuries, it is fundamentally a breach in that story. And so one way to think about this is that a kind of a life quake is a disruptive event and that the life story is the healing event. Like that's the way that you make sense and make peace with the disruptive event. It is, in effect, an autobiographical occasion. And so the point about, stories are told from scars, not wounds, is when it's, you know, when that life upheaval is at its rawest, in effect, when it's still an open wound, you can't fully tell the story yet because you haven't gotten through it. That somehow the act of getting through it and piecing it together and determining what it means and sort of deciding a new direction of where you're going, that's the process that turns the wound into a scar that finally allows you to tell the story. It's why in the seven tools that I have in the book, Life is in the Transitions, the last one is to unveil the new story because it's at the end of the process that you can finally piece together the various experiences and actually, in effect, add a new chapter to the story of your life that accommodates the loss of the loved one, the loss of income, the loss of job, the loss of legs, the lack of beliefs that you used to have, the new political position that you've taken, the new relationships that you have formed. That's the way to think about this, is that a life quake is an autobiographical occasion when we have to kind of rethink, and then reshare the story of who we are.
A similar insight came from Matt Dixon, a triathlon coach who trains the who's who of Silicon Valley. He speaks about having a grieving window with the athlete where they stay away from analysis. It's a bit like the wound phase that Bruce Feiler talks about.
What happens when you do have a really poor performance? And I think there's a phase or a series of phases that you go through. The first is to lean into the grieving of it. And so when an athlete has a bad race, the first thing that we avoid is immediate analysis, trying to find the solution or the reason for that failure within the first 48 hours, because it's impossible to think logically, think clearly, and objectively and analyze yourself and how you went into that race with a clear head when you have the pain that is there. So instead, we give, and we talk about this, the grieving process. We give you, for the athlete, 24 to 72 hours, depending on the size of the event or the impact that it's had on them, just to be, just to let it marinate. And then we go through and we do a really objective analysis. And I think this is really important, not just in failure, but also in success. Why did we succeed? And why did we fail? And when we think about that component, we look at it really anchors on controllable and things that were out of your control. So did you do everything that was necessary that you were trained to do in order to be successful? And those are the areas that are actionable.
I have found the notion of the grieving window or not making sense of wounds very, very helpful. I find that when things don't go per plan, we have a temptation to do a post-mortem right away and get to the bottom of the situation when it's still quite raw. But given the surge of emotions that we experience at that time, I notice that we are not in a position to make meaningful decisions. I remember I was in McKinsey, New Jersey at that time, and I had come down for a short-term transfer to India to take care of my father's cancer treatment in 2008. When he passed away in 6 months, I remember I had gone down to thank his oncologist for his support. He asked me what my plans were, and I remember telling him at that time that I'd like to stay back in India to support my mom. I still vividly remember him looking me in the eye and asking me not to take any big decisions for 3 to 6 months. At that time, I didn't appreciate the gravity of the advice, but now I see what he was saying. I don't think I was seeing things clearly when I was in the vortex of the storm. It's a different matter that I eventually decided to stay back, and I'm very happy with the decision, but I think the advice is still relevant. Just being mindful of the recovery and the reimagination phase, as Ramesh says, or the wounds versus scars, as Bruce Feiler says, or the grieving phase, as Matt Dixon says. I guess they're all making the same broad point. The next insight I wanted to share with you comes from Dan Pink, an author of many books. I spoke to him in the context of his book on regret. He makes a very interesting observation about how sometimes bronze medalists are happier than silver medalists. And the answer has a lot to do with how we frame a situation and the language we use. He calls it counterfactual thinking.
So this is some really interesting research started. Actually, the initial research on this came out in 1992, so it's 30 years ago at the Barcelona Olympics. Tom Gilovich at Cornell and Vicky Medvick, now at Northwestern, then at Cornell, did some really interesting research. And what they did is that they showed, as you say, the photographs of Olympians at the medal stand. And what it showed is exactly what you said. Gold medalists are ecstatic. Bronze medalists are really happy. And silver medalists aren't that happy, even though they got the silver medal at the Olympics. And so the reason has to do with, again, our incredible brains. Our brains are, the more I write about behavior and brains, the more I'm just in awe of what our brains can do. I mean, it's extraordinary what our brains can do. It's extraordinary. And one of the things our brains can do is something known as counterfactual thinking. That is, we can imagine scenarios that run counter to the facts. And there are two kinds of counterfactual thinking. One of them is a downward counterfactual, where you imagine how things could have gone worse. And so I don't like downward counterfactual. It's too complicated. I like to call it an at least. And so the bronze medalists are like, oh, at least I got a bronze medalist rather than the schmo who finished fourth, who doesn't have any medal at all. So they imagine. So here's the thing, at least make us feel better. And that's okay. That's actually a psychological, that can be a healthy way of doing things, a healthy way of interpreting events. The silver medalist is saying, if only I had kicked a little harder in the final turn, I'd have won the 100-meter freestyle race. And that's an upward counterfactual. If onlys make us feel worse, but they make us do better. And so this is another way of understanding. And so regret is the quintessential upward counterfactual. It can help us do better. It makes us feel worse and helps us do better. It helps us do better because it makes us feel worse.
So from a performance perspective, Dan, just building on what you just said, how do you work with these two, right? At some level, in a way you're saying we need to have some sort of a switch that flips. You know, when we are practicing, some sort of a upward counterfactual is helpful. But once the results are out, it helps to take the other view. So do you have a view on
how we play with this? It depends. Okay, so here's the thing. Let's take an example like let's see if we can figure out a career example here, which might be more relevant. So let's say that so here we go. So let's say that somebody, we'll call him Vishal, all right? So let's say Vishal takes a job. It's a childhood friend of my, one of my kids, all right? So let's say Vishal takes a job, and it is a, and he hates it. It's terrible. It's a terrible job. He really doesn't like it, okay? And he realizes that he made some mistakes in even taking the job. It wasn't that there were warning signs ahead of time. Okay, so he's feeling regret about that. Now, what can Vishal do about that? So what Vishal can do about that is say, if only I had done more due diligence ahead of time, and researched this company a little bit more. If only I had talked to three people who were in this position beforehand. I would not have made this choice. Okay. And he can take those lessons and carry him forward and looking for his next job, knowing now that he has to do some due diligence, that he has to find surrogates for that kind of job, that he has to maybe talk to his mentor, because maybe he didn't talk to his mentor to get some advice on that. Okay. So he's like, okay, I really messed up here. Now that feels bad. He can still get that instruction and mitigate some of the pain, not all of it, by saying, but at least I got paid decently, so I'm not in the hole. And so you can do both. Now, if he were simply to say, at least I'm getting paid decently, he's not going to change. He's going to be stuck in that bad situation. So it's possible to do, it's possible to do an if only without an at least, but sometimes if you're willing to take the pain of the if only, as Vishal just did, you can mitigate some of the pain with an at least.
Got it. And is the at least the sort of the conceptual point there similar to the notion of gratitude, having gratitude for what we have?
That's interesting. That's a really interesting way to put it. I'm not sure. I never thought about it that way, but I think that's a really nice way to put it. I think that's probably my hunch. I don't know. Is that they're probably adjacent or connected in the roots or somewhere. That's a great point. I never thought about that, but it probably is. At least are a way to essentially recontextualize your situation in order to make yourself feel better. But the problem is with at least, and that's okay sometimes. The problem is that at least don't help you do better. At least confer zero performance benefit. They mitigate some pain, and mitigating pain is cool, but they don't offer any instruction.
There is a lovely TED Talk by an award-winning photographer, Duett Jones. The topic is, celebrate what is right with the world. Very often, when we go through a life quake, celebrating what is right, or at leasting it, as Dan Pink says, might offer us some solace as we take stock and move forward. The last piece I wanted to share on being resilient individually comes from Rich Fernandez, CEO of Search Inside Yourself, a leadership development organization incubated in Google. Rich speaks about three levels of resilience: inner calm, emotional resilience, and cognitive resilience.
Well, inner calm is the first thing that we talked about earlier, which is the skill of mindfulness and being able to manage your attention. And so something happens when you're able to direct your attention to the present moment via breath, mantra, whatever you call it, where you become calm, right? And less reactive, because you're just simply grounded and focused. So that's the habit of inner calm, is the habit of mindfulness. Emotional resilience happens when you're able to become aware of the emotions that you're having as you're having them. This has a little bit more to do with open monitoring that I was discussing earlier. you're noticing what's arising within you as an emotion, as it's arising in real time. And it allows you then to take that distance that I was talking about, to exercise that response flexibility, right? When you're aware of your emotions, you're able to manage them. When you're aware of your emotions, you're able to respond rather than react. Now, some listeners might say, well, look, Rich, it's really important to react. I'm in a business where I have to react. And I would say to you, unless you're experiencing an existential threat, like your life is in jeopardy, it's going to always be far more effective to respond rather than react. Because responding doesn't mean going slow.
True.
Think of, so let me give you an example to make this really concrete and really, really clear. Have you ever been in an airplane and experienced heavy turbulence?
Absolutely.
You have, right? I'm sure the listeners have too, right? Who do you want in the cockpit in that moment? Somebody who's reacting and just alarmed and on fire, or someone who's calm, competent, clear-headed, and knows exactly what needs to happen and when it needs to happen?
Hmm. You want Captain Sully,
Yes, you want Captain Sully Sullenberg. I've actually met the man. He came to give a talk at Google, and he is that way when you meet him. He is like one of the calmest, most grounded people I know. But what does he say, actually? He says that he trained, and this is, by the way, for the listeners who aren't familiar with Captain Sully Sullenberger, he's the man who landed the jet plane that was flying over New York City. It flew through a flock of geese, so they lost all jet propulsion, because the geese flew into the engine and burnt them out. So in the space, I think, of about 3 minutes, he had to make a split-second decision to land the airplane on the Hudson River. It was the only available large open space over New York City. But he thought about this very, very calmly. Okay, so I'd ask you to Google or YouTube it. You'll see the interview with him where he explains it. But how did he do that? He says he trained his whole career for it. He said, I have 30 years as a pilot. And so I just know the routines. I knew what needed to happen, right? And he just calmly proceeded to do that. He didn't react and become overblown or overwhelmed by the situation. And this is why, you know, we talk about emotional resilience as being a key quality of a leader in the digital economy. And then the last piece, Deepak, because you asked me about this, was cognitive resilience. And this is simply your mental outlook. It's very simple. It's one of two things. It's optimism versus pessimism. Mm-hmm. And studies have shown that people that have positive outlook and that are optimistic are people that see possibilities, and they feel agency. They feel like they're able to act against those possibilities and that they themselves can have a positive impact on making those possibilities a reality. That's what an optimist does. Pessimists tend to be people who actually take a disempowered mentality. They often feel like they're victims. They often feel like injustice simply exists and there's very little you can do against it. So why bother even trying? They fall into cynicism. And it's not particularly effective as a leader to be a terrible pessimist, because you feel like you can actually, you know, make progress against difficulties. So that's what, and you can cultivate, by the way, cognitive resilience by actually doing things like, you know, expressing gratitude and looking at, positive qualities in positive attributes in your life or those around you.
Got it. And you spoke about inner calm, cultivating inner calm, but on the emotional resilience, coming back to what you said about Sully Sullenberger, Any observations on how people can cultivate emotional resilience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the process of starts with open monitoring and developing that self-awareness, right, of emotional processes that are happening in your body as they're happening. So this is a type of meditation. You can do this as a type of meditation and simply allow your, or read the book or, you know, take one of our programs. We teach you to kind of become aware of thought, feeling, sensation, and just kind of move through those different domains of experience. You could do sight, you could do smell, touch. just notice, go through the categories of experience and just simply notice what is happening for you in that moment. And that will then build the skill of open awareness so that when you do face a situation where you're triggered in real life and have these difficulties, you're immediately aware of what you're feeling, right?
Got it.
If you can name it, then you can actually manage it. Very much like Peter Drucker said, you have to be able to measure it to manage it. Hmm. Well, in this exercise of emotional resilience, you have to be able to name it to then be able to manage it. And to respond to it versus react to it. And if you ask most people, you know, when they're really triggered, when they're really, let's say, pissed off, they can't really explain what they're feeling.
Hmm.
Right. And so the more fluent you become in your own, the emotionally literate you become about your own emotions, your own internal ecosystem, then the more emotionally resilient you'll be able to be. And you develop, again, that skill by being able to monitor your own experience as you're having it.
If you have not seen the movie Sully, directed by Clint Eastwood, and the role played by Tom Hanks, is a wonderful movie where you can see the distinction between reacting and responding, like Rich says. Emotional resilience and agility also leads me to another interesting insight I had learned from my conversation with David Noble and Carol Kaufman, co-authors of the book Real Leadership. We often use the term willpower in the context of being resilient. They actually go on to say that way power is sometimes often more useful than willpower. The ability to be agile and think of multiple ways to solve a situation than trying to muscle your way through the one approach, which is often your default approach.
So let me just set that up, and then Carol can talk about the four stances, because those are, that's one way of finding four ways to win. And there's also many other ways to find four ways to win in the book. It's a really crucial thing. But the premise is that because volatility is on an escalating trajectory, we get nonlinear kind of curveballs and obstacles thrown at us all the time. So what we find is that good leaders can identify one way to win. But in many cases these days, you need a backup to that plan and you need a backup to the backup. So that's why we want to have way power, which is multiple ways forward, because the more viable options you have to achieve a goal, again, the more likely you are to achieve the goal. And then Carol can pick it up for the stances.
Right. And there's a lot of research based on this. Many, many studies have looked at it and looked at predicting success based on, do people have this way power? Where does this come from? It comes from the four main reflexes that we all have, which are fight, flight, freeze, and befriend. Befriend is a new one in terms of people understanding it. And that is, you know, if you see a little kid in front of a bus coming on, you don't think whether or not you should save them. You just, it's a reflex to just grab them. We've translated this into what we call the four stances. So mm-hmm. if you watch tennis, for example, or even play it, it's not what they do with the arms. It's how they set their legs, the stance they take before. It's a forehand, a different stance for a backhand or close to the net, etc. And that's basically what we think is, what is sort of your default stance that you can take? And then how can you expand it? And the four stances are, in a nutshell, first, you know, lean in, lean back, don't lean, or lean with. So lean in is rolling up your sleeves, really engaging. If there's a conflict, going there. Now, it doesn't mean you lean in a directive way. It means you're actively engaged. It could be edgy. It could be enthusiastic with a lot of zest. It could be with the delicacy of a ballerina or the intensity of a rugby player. So there's many ways. And in the book, we actually have a host of examples and directions that you can take. So that's lean in. Lean back is basically data-driven, inquiry-driven. I'm going to take a lean back. I'm going to look at the topography. I'm going to look at the data. I'm going to be very rational in what I'm thinking and in my choices. If I have to do a reduction in force, I'm not going to be leaping in and doing that. I'm going to really get out my spreadsheets and figure out what's right. Leaning with is leading with caring, concern, nurturance. And if it's at scale, it's culture. If you have a merger and acquisition, you know, your integration, you're going to kind of be thinking people first. So lean in is action first. Lean back is, you know, data first. Lean with is people first. And don't lean at all is reflection first. And the capacity to not lean, which is the toughest of all, requires a decision to be able to tolerate doing nothing for, it could be seconds, it could be moments, it could be a decision. And that would be, so why does that one matter? One reason it matters is the other three are all kind of what your brain is producing. This one is making a reflective space so an idea can like hit you. It kind of opens you up to kind of intuition or kind of new thoughts. One way, simple example is, let's say, okay, so Deepak, you're giving a talk and it's kind of important to you. And maybe it's even being filmed. And then somebody in the audience sneers at you and really like, you know, has that like, this is so stupid. I can't believe we're wasting our time. Okay. So you can imagine the different stances. You would respond rather differently. So you, if you're going to lean in, you might say, excuse me, what's going on? Or like, okay, I'm not going to look like a bully in front of everyone, but I'm going to talk to this person after the meeting. Okay. Leaning back, it may be like, okay, what's the data? What might the person be responding to? What are they thinking? What is the best way for me to like interact in this moment? Like, I'm just going to go with the data. Now, leaning with, I'm like, oh no, what did I do? Like, you know, like this person, I've offended them. And I might like then the whole rest of the talk be like honing in on them and making them like what I'm doing. But don't lean is, I'm just not triggered. This person has sneered and it's nearly a non-event for me. I will just go on, I'm reflecting and I don't have to react. So those are the four stances and one way you can think about them.
I think that the not leaning is the most difficult one, as Carol said. And that's something because as leaders, we're all very action-oriented. But when you think about it, it can manifest not just in allowing your intuition to come to the surface or to take a moment to calm yourself, but also sometimes you can just wait and hopefully your team is going to fill that void. You don't always have to act on everything. And, you know, that team should be filling that space in many cases, too, rather than you leaning in. And then also, you know, the example of letting the sneer go. Sometimes when there's something, you don't actually have to confront it. You don't have to deal with it. You can just turn aside and let it go right past you. So it's actually a very powerful stance that's quite underused in the repertoire of post leaders.
They say that very often, where there is a will, there are often four different ways. They say that we could engage with the situation in four different ways. Lean in, lean back, do not lean at all, and lean with. The next perspective I wanted to share here comes from Bruce Feiler. He speaks about how resilience is such a beaten up word, and he brings out an interesting dimension to resilience. He says that very often when we think of resilience, we think of bouncing back. But he goes on to speak about how we could shape shift into a completely new orbit. A bit like post-COVID, none of us went back to the old normal. We came to a new normal.
Well, let me first of all just say that there has not been a more fetishized word in business and in life in the last decade than resilience. And the problem with resilience is that resilience is one of those words and ideas that grew up back in the linear age, back when our lives were shaped by the factory and by industrial manufacturing. The resilience actually is a term of physics that began with the spring. And so the idea was that you would pull the spring, and how resilient, quote unquote, the spring was how far the spring would spring back into its original position. So that implies that you go back after going through a life transition. And some people go back, but frankly, many more people go sideways or forward or to a different direction altogether. So resilience is not the model. And the pandemic is a perfect example of this. If you think when it first happened, we all thought, oh, we're going to wait 6 weeks and we're going to go back to normal. Well, we're looking at a year plus at this point. And what we've now learned is we're not going back. We're going to a different place. And in fact, that's why when we get in, you know, as we go forward in this conversation and start talking about the various kind of stages and phases of a life transition, that the first one is to say goodbye to the world that is not coming back, the world without the loved one or without the job or without the title or without the legs or whatever has been lost in the original lifequake. So instead, what happens is that we rethink what's important to us. And so kind of the quick and dirty on the idea of the shape, back to the original shape conversation we were having, is that there are kind of three pillars we have to how we make meaning in our lives. I call them the ABCs of meaning. And the A is agency, what we do or make or create. The B is belonging, our relationships, our colleagues, our friends, our loved ones, our co-religionists, the people we volunteer with. And then the C is a cause, a calling, a purpose, sort of something higher than ourselves. So we all have a way that we kind of balance these. I'm an ABC. I'm a writer, so I'm very agentic. I'm very involved with family and a very active dad. And cause is kind of less important to me. My wife, Linda Rotenberg, who started and runs an organization called Endeavor that supports high-impact entrepreneurs in 50 countries around the world, she's very cause-oriented. She gives back to entrepreneurs all over the planet. Then she's very agentic because she's, you know, a founder and a builder and a social entrepreneur. Relationships, you know, she tolerates the rest of us. So she's like a CAB. So what tends to happen when we go through a lifequake is that we rebalance. Like maybe we've been working very hard and we want to spend more time with our family, or maybe we've been a caretaker or caring for an aging relative or a child, and maybe we're now moving on from that and we want to give back. Or maybe we've been giving back in our career and we want to do something more for ourselves. So what tends to happen in these lifequakes is, because they are sort of breaks in the normal, they are opportunities, and in some ways I would even say obligations, to rethink what's most important to us, and allows us to kind of breathe, take stock, and maybe then shift our priorities somewhat.
If I take my personal example, I had a lifequake when I was at McKinsey in New Jersey, and I had to relocate to India to take care of my father's treatment. 15 years later, I noticed that I didn't quite go back to where I came from. I shape-shifted from being a strategy consultant to becoming a search consultant and subsequently a coach, sounding board, and a podcaster. Had you spoken to me about these in 2006, I would have laughed away at the suggestion of me walking this path. But the life quake opened up these shape-shifting possibilities in ways that I could not have imagined at that time. So far, in this episode, we've been speaking about building resilience as an individual. Let's now try and turn our attention to how we can build resilience in an organization. If you're the CEO, what could you do to develop resilience in the system? I wanted to share a few perspectives in this context. The first one comes from Amy Edmondson of Harvard Business School. She was recently voted as the world's number one thinker by Thinkers 50, considered by many as an equivalent to Oscar awards in the movie industry. I guess there's a lot of literature out there on what is psychological safety in a team or in an organization, so I don't want to waste your time getting into it. But Amy speaks about how we can create safety in the organization. And of the many things she suggests, the one thing that stayed with me was the notion of creating rituals. She speaks about Pixar that has a ritual called Brain Trust, and Google X, which has a museum of failures.
Sure, I mean, we talked about Pixar before, and they use this ritual, which they label the brain trust, and it is a ritual. It's a ritual of coming together with some periodic schedule to evaluate the work together, to figure out what's working and what isn't. And the ritual itself, you can just imagine people know it's coming. All rituals are things that we expect, we know, we participate in. Doesn't make them always fun or always easy, certainly not, but they are expected and they're part of who we are and how we do things. In medicine, there's rituals like the morbidity and mortality meetings, you know, the sort of weekly meetings on a Friday, usually where clinicians come together and they together dig into the details of a case that didn't work out well. And they try to understand together in a very thoughtful way what happened and what went wrong. And you can imagine that's not easy, particularly given what's at stake. But it's a ritual. And I think the ritual aspect of it makes it more palatable. That's kind of an extreme case. But rituals in companies, I've been intrigued to find that rituals like failure parties, you know, when a really smart, thoughtful experiment didn't go well anyway, even though it was really smart, it was a worthwhile thing to try and it didn't work. Let's have, you know, let's celebrate the effort and the hypothesis and the discovery that failure allowed.
Correct. You talk about Eli Lilly where there are failure parties. Yes, and you also talk about
exactly.
Google X.
That's a ritual.
Yeah, Google X, which actually has a what I read as a museum of failures, if you will, of some sorts. So could you sort of expand on some of these fascinating, some of these rituals on the extreme, just to provoke ideas?
I mean, I think Google X has the museum of failures. They also have... they also have celebrations of the failures because they are explicit in their desire and their goal to break new boundaries, to be really innovative and going after very hard problems and making a big difference in hard problems. And they recognize wisely that if that's your ambition, more often than not, things will fail. And so if you don't reward that failure, people will just stop taking risks. And if people stop taking risks, you won't accomplish your dreams. So to help people be willing to take those risks, you've got the psychology of it is that these rituals like the failure parties, the failure awards are really powerful.
If we take the quote, failure is a stepping stone to success, I would like to assert that psychological safety is the cement on which the stepping stone is built that helps us build the staircase to success. It can make all the difference between growing from failure to crumbling under it. In this context, I want to share an example closer home of a leader who is a great example of someone who's built resilience in an organization. Suresh Narayanan was parachuted in when in 2014 and 15, food safety regulators in Uttar Pradesh found lead and monosodium glutamate in Maggi, an iconic brand that had almost come to define a category, like Xerox. This finding led to several states banning Maggi and a significant dip in Maggi's sales and Nestle's reputation. It was in this context that Suresh was brought in from Philippines to handle the situation. When we spoke on the podcast, one of the questions I asked Suresh was how one builds resilience in an organization. He spoke about three things: attitude, discipline, and teamwork.
It is surprising, Deepak, how sometimes we pay very little heed to the 6 inches between our ears. Hmm. Right? To me, resilience begins with a capital A, attitude. It has got nothing to do with how well qualified you are, how intelligent you are, how strategic you are. It is you have a problem in front of you. What is your attitude prima facie? What does your gut tell you that I should do? For me, a problem is always an opportunity. I see it as an opportunity. I say, wow, this has happened. Let's go and try and do the best we can to, number one, come out of it and come out of it stronger. So resilience is built from a deep sense of commitment and attitude that I will overcome. Number two is discipline. Resilience demands discipline. It demands the capability to say, I will repeat this action again and again and again and not give up. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that these sets of actions are what is going to get us out of the hole. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to be giving up and saying, okay, fine, let me try something else. Let me try. Because in a crisis situation, you'll have 25 different advice coming to you. Mm. But you need to, as a leader, take the call and say, this is what I will do. So second spirit is discipline. Third, teamwork. Resilience is not just your personal resilience, but it is the capability you have to transmit it in your team. And that's when I point out to the fact that in leadership, it is not important sometimes what you say, but how you say it. Mm. You can get the most bitter news across people and they will smile. Mm. And you can get the sweetest news across and they will frown.
Right.
Right. And I think that the leader has to understand that in a situation that demands resilience, how he says things is as important as what he says.
And give us an example or a little bit of color around this theme, the how.
Look, I will say, like, when I first came on the Maggie crisis,
right.
I think the first meeting I had, you know, within 24 hours, I had a meeting with my team. We had a town hall here. And the first thing I told them was, I said, look, and I really genuinely meant it because I love this team. And that's why I think one of the reasons why I came back was because I genuinely love the Nestle India organization who have given me so much. I said, look, I'm delighted to be back in this team. I know you give me a lot of trust and you give me a lot of respect. But let me start by saying that we will come out of whatever situation we find ourselves in, even though I don't have the answers. Right? A leader, when he transmits sincerity and trust, but he also transmits vulnerability, becomes a more lasting leader than a superhero who walks in saying, I know all the answers. Come on, guys, let's go and do it. Mm. You know, when there is a fire around and you don't know where the fire has started, if the guy comes and says, no, chill. Mm. I know exactly what is to be done. You kind of get a bit wary.
I hear you.
Right? So, I think these are
humanness.
This is humanness. This is vulnerability. Because what happens is, the minute I open that window of vulnerability that I don't know all the answers, I had 20 people come up to me and said, sir, I think we could do this. I think we could do this. I think we could do this. The minute I say, I know all the answers, people will say, yeah, okay, fine, he knows all the answers. Mm. And why should I tell him something? He may take it badly. Mm. Right? The other thing is, in trying to get and dissect the root cause of a problem, if you take the approach of doing a clinical inquisition, that who's to blame, the outcomes are very different from if you were to do actually a decision tree to say what are the different things that we could do or that we could have done. Then people move away from being threatened to a sense of involvement in what you're doing. How we frame the inquiry. So these are things that you have to understand the cultures well. Sometimes in some cultures, let's say in Europe, this might have been seen as a very roundabout way of getting to the problem. I mean, the question would have been, you know, what's the bloody problem? You know, who's the guy who's behind it? Let's clean it up and move on.
Especially in a place like Netherlands, Germany, maybe, whereas
in India, the minute I started saying, you know, Deepak, you are the guy. Okay, fine. Let's have a conversation. How I treat Deepak will immediately transmit itself in 200 people and they'll say, Suresh is a nasty guy. Don't go to him, don't suggest, because it will bite you.
I love the fact that Suresh refers to vulnerability and how it can build trust and followership in an organization. That brings us to the last insight in this episode, which comes from Dheeraj Pandey of Nutanix, who we heard from earlier.
Dheeraj connects the dots across two very seemingly separate disciplines. He talks about the parallels between the fragility spectrum that Nassim Nicholas Taleb talks about and the honesty spectrum that Mike Robbins refers to and discusses the connection between the two. He also shares some perspectives around how to build authenticity and anti-fragility in every aspect of the business.
You know, one thing, again, going back to drawing parallels, you know, I really believe the more things change, the more they remain the same. So this Mike Robbins idea of authenticity is highly parallel to Nicholas Taleb's idea of anti-fragility. Uh-huh. Because they both talk about a spectrum. Uh-huh. You know, on the left of Taleb's spectrum is fragile systems.
Right.
On the middle of Taleb's spectrum is resilient systems. Yeah. Which is like honesty, like, wow, resilience is not good enough. Yeah. So if you apply pressure to the system and if it goes back to the original state, that's not good enough. Just like honesty is not good enough. So, and both of them apply very similar principles of shock or vulnerability to make it better.
Fascinating.
It's just amazingly fascinating. And this is my epiphany moment that, wow, there are two seemingly disparate things that have the exact same parallels, you know, in terms of the continuum and so on. So anti-fragility and shocks that Taleb attaches to those things is similar to honesty plus vulnerability makes you more authentic, which is what, you know, anti-fragile is. So I think learning from shocks, being vulnerable, are things that are very, very closely tied to my psyche now.
Mm-hmm. What does being vulnerable mean from a leadership standpoint? What sort of behaviors will you break it down to?
Well, in everything that we do as a business, as engineers, as architects, as product managers, we need to have caveats. Like when we write a design doc, we need to have something that says, and these are the things that we've not considered. And by the way, these are the things that it does not address.
Right.
In a product requirements document, we talk about trade-offs, you know, about what kind of things it does. And all of a sudden, it's more authentic. Mm. When you actually talk about the fact that we've not considered these things, you are reducing friction. Mm. When you do press releases, you don't talk about industry leader. I hate the word industry leader, self-proclaimed monikers like industry leaders. It's like, look, we're just trying to be something, and we've not achieved that thing, you know, and along the way, we should talk about how we could still fail, you know. And when you say that, all of a sudden, the audience lowers the guard and says, you know what, this is believable because it's human to be vulnerable, actually. You do the same thing in board meetings, you know. How do you actually go there and not try to be this superhuman with a mantle of perfection around you that, you know, is highly impregnable business professional that was basically running a perfect show and so on. Instead, if you look at your board members as human beings and as people you can learn from and they're willing to help you with some of those things, all of a sudden is a much better board environment than if you had to look at them as people who are overseeing you or something.
Got it. And on culture, how do you think about injecting anti-fragility into your culture at Nutanix? How have you gone about doing that?
I mean, if you think about B2B, and again, similar to B2C as well, customer success is everything. And technologies are never perfect. Products are never perfect. So I look around and look at what really is common about the best brands in the world. Mm-hmm. It's customer service. You know, you look at the best brands in the world, they could be in completely disparate industries, but the one thing they have in common is loyalty from the customer, which comes because of customer service. It's the human-to-human thing that actually connects businesses to people or consumers, actually. You know? And I was listening to Deepak Chopra 3 years ago, and he said, look, the richest people in the world, they don't buy things. They buy experiences. Right? So how do you deliver that experience during the lows? Well, obviously, technologies fail. So if you go and make it memorable, you know, this idea that you're apologetic and you're vulnerable, and yet you will improve the situation, that's what people remember. Mm. They don't remember the fact that your product failed. What they remember is how you came together to really make it better and make their overall experience way better as well. These are the war stories that humans want to remember. Same thing with software. I mean, we talk about self-healing. It's at the core of machine learning and AI is that man does less and machine does more. So what does it mean for machine to do more? Machine learns from another machine about its inherent vulnerability, and it tries to improve by recovering on its own and stuff like that. You know, like we run software on commodity hardware. The word commodity is highly vulnerable because, you know, commodity hardware fails a lot. So how does software recover from that? And in this state of being that says, look, it's okay for hardware to fail, I'll go and make it better. I'll be able to, before I alert the human, I know exactly what it means for the software to recover and self-heal and so on. I think they are all very important parts of a design of the next generation systems where a man does less and less, and the man-machine interface is not crossed as often as we used to in the past. You know, humans do as little as possible, and machines can do more because machines are anti-fragile.
With this, we come to the end of the episode. I sincerely hope that you found the compilation helpful. If you find this content of value, do take a moment and rate and review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you consume the content. Do also consider sharing this with the communities you belong to. A short WhatsApp message to your classmates, friends, or colleagues could go a long way in spreading the word and us continuing on this mission of creating content that provokes you and gets you to play to your potential. Thank you for listening and your attention. And I look forward to having you in one of the subsequent conversations at the podcast. Bye now.